Skipping over Pete Alonso here a little bit. We talked about this earlier in the show. Mets seem to have moved on. I don't, in my opinion, that could have been said, but in the back of their minds, I feel like they still do want Pete. I feel like it's the right move. I know now Toronto's back in the mix of talking. A couple things. Is there any other teams you think that are involved in Pete Alonso? Do you think he's going to get the money he deserves by one of these teams? And, you know, talk about what you and Will Salmon said on it. You guys have been doing a great job about these articles. Talk a little bit about this situation and where you see this directing towards.
Todd, I'm not convinced the Mets want Pete. And the reason I say that is because of their offer. 3 years, 68 to 70 million, as Joel Sherman first reported in the New York Post. That's not an offer he was going to take, and they know that. So my feeling is they are ready to move on. And that's what you've been hearing. That's what people have been writing, like myself and others. And it seems to me that I don't know that they ever really wanted Pete, because if they did, they could have made an offer that would have obviously been more persuasive to him. Now, the Jays reported this yesterday, and they are in on Pete Alonso. And I've heard that there's one other team in, but I don't know who that team is. I know how people get crazy when we start talking about mystery teams, but the Blue Jays are not a mystery team on Alonso. And in addition, what we reported was if they sign Pete Alonso, they're not trading Vladimir Guerrero Jr., or at least that's not the intent. They're still negotiating or trying to negotiate with Guerrero, though they haven't talked to him in a while. Those talks will accelerate again before his self-imposed deadline when the first position player workout takes place. That's February 18th for the Jays. So the Jays have been trying for 2 years now to make their team as strong as possible. They're desperate to sign a big free agent. They struck out on Otani, struck out on Soto. They're still trying, struck out on Corbin Burns. Alonso would be an intriguing guy for them. Guerrero could play third. He wants to play third. You could DH both those guys. So there's a fit there. Whether it gets done or not, I don't know. But that is real. The other team, whoever that might be, I don't know. But I always caution people, teams come out of nowhere in free agency often. The Jays came out of nowhere on Sasaki. They came out of nowhere on Alonso. So would it shock me if a team was lurking on Alonso and ready to come out of nowhere? No, that would not shock me in the least.
It's another edition of the Talking Mets podcast here on this Sunday, January the 19th, 2025. Of course, I'm your host, Mike Silva. You can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. You can get me on X at Talking Mets No G and on your favorite podcasting service, Apple, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at talkingmetspodcast.com. No G, Mike Silva at talkingmetspodcast.com. You can get me on Instagram, Talking Mets No G, and don't forget the newsletter, substack.com/@TalkingMetsNoG. And I want to thank the good folks from the Fan-Sided Podcasting Network for supporting this show. Welcome to a snowy Sunday night edition of the Talking Mets podcast. Pull up a cup of coffee, hot chocolate, whatever your beverage is that you desire, and let's talk a little baseball. We're going to do things a little bit differently tonight. Big week ahead. Not only a lot of Mets news and discussion around not only the Mets, but what the Dodgers are doing out in LA, but also the announcement that's coming on Tuesday with the Hall of Fame, and you'll be getting my Hall of Fame ballot. So what I'm going to do is tonight's show, part one, we're just going to talk hot stove, Mets baseball. We'll get into all the Pete Alonso stuff. I know we had a show just a couple of days ago. News has transpired since then, and we'll make this all about the Mets. Now, the announcements on Tuesday in the afternoon for this year's Hall of Fame inductees, you already have a couple, Dick Allen and Dave Parker. While we were all following Juan Soto, those guys by the Veterans Committee, the classic baseball era, were inducted in. Dick Allen, a very underrated player, by the way, immensely underrated. So Congratulations to those guys. So we'll get into that a little bit, but that'll be part two. So part two will be released tomorrow. I know tomorrow's a holiday, so maybe you'll be taking some time off and you get some more Talking Mets. But right now, today on Sunday, as we bring the weekend to a close, we're going to be talking Mets baseball. So this is part one of two parts. So stay tuned. There'll be more. Of course, those who are paid subscribers to the newsletter get it immediately as soon as it goes out. And those that are on the Apple or their favorite podcasting service wait a little bit longer. And obviously have to deal with the commercials, which I apologize for, but helps keep the lights on here for what we do. Now, anyway, so let's get down to business here. It's January 19th. There are a ton of free agents out there. Obviously, the big news that has come out over the last 72 hours or so, the Mets and Pete Alonso appear to be headed to a divorce. I think we're all surprised that we're here. What may be less of a surprise this week is the Dodgers flexing their financial muscle, and maybe that's a loose term because, again, it's deferrals, 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 and Tanner Scott, somebody that the Mets had their eye on. They wound up settling for A.J. Minter. I don't think that that's necessarily a bad thing. I think that they're a lot more similar, these guys, than you think. Tanner Scott, the rich get richer. The Dodgers improve their bullpen with Tanner Scott and give him a four-year, $72 million deal, pretty much rivaling a little bit what the AAV would be. Not quite Edwin Diaz, but in that neighborhood. And I'm a little bit surprised, but metrics with missed bats and things that you look at outside of the traditional stats probably is leading to the fact that the Dodgers, with their top-notch pitching development programs that they do over there, feel that they could maybe get the best out of what Tanner Scott could offer. Struggled a lot as a member of the Orioles, has found his way with Miami the last couple of years, and then was traded for a bundle of prospects to San Diego, which I'm all for going for it, but man, if you don't see what all the prospects that San Diego gave up for Scott and how they just got a couple of months out of him and a division series, and then basically at this point they're left with nothing. I don't think he had the qualifying offer attached to him, but it goes to show you that you really need to develop relievers. You got to get good or do what the Mets do and try to find good value on shorter-term deals. But we'll start, before we get to Alonso and the Mets' response with Jesse Winker and A.J. Minter and where they're going and whatnot, I think that we have to take a look at a little bit at what everybody's complaining about right now when it comes to the Dodgers. So everybody's up in arms about the Dodgers, what they're doing to the sport. They bring in Tanner Scott. They get Roky Sasaki, which they recruited him. And, you know, everybody's angry, and you need an international draft, and you need, some say, a salary cap. The deferrals are not good for the game. You have to stop that, and the Dodgers are ruining the sport. And we've been here before. In a lot of ways, we've been here with the Yankees, but I will say the Yankees never were able to, at the same time, at their peak, put together their financial might with a top-notch player development system. As a matter of fact, the Yankees built their dynasty on the core four or core five, depending on how you look at Bernie Williams, and that was through the farm system when George was suspended. And then they used their financial might, as George was the first to take his brand, and the fact that the league is not like the NFL where everybody shares in revenues and there's no salary cap. And he went out there, and the Yankees were the place that everybody wanted to be. They were the it brand, and he went out there and leveraged it, and he would bring in top free agent after top free agent after top free agent. And then around 2004, 2005, when the Red Sox started to implement Moneyball and really balance out money with looking at players a little bit different. I mean, actually, it was the A's, but I think the Red Sox took it to the next level. Things started to change a little bit, and the gap closed. And since then, things have swung back and forth. But at any point in time, the Yankees, for all the criticism that you could give, which are naturally in the Mets' backyard here, so we see them all the time, they've never been able to put it together quite like the Dodgers have, where they've taken financial might, they've taken brand building, they've taken development, they've taken the international cachet. I mean, the Yankees used to own Japan, if you think about it, with I'm losing my train of thought. Back in the 90s, Hideki Arabu, there he is. I can try to get the name. Tanaka, Kuruta, obviously Matsui. I mean, on and on and on. The Yankees always would dominate Japan. Now it's the Dodgers. And when you have an all-time star like Ohtani that decides to pick the Dodgers and make the Dodgers his team, it's not hard to see why those who grew up idolizing somebody who is the LeBron James maybe of the sport, not maybe, probably is, why they'd want to play with him. And I'm not going to sit here and complain and say the sport needs fixing. I think the sport needs fixing, but I'm not sure going out there and taking money out of players' pockets with a salary cap or de-incentivizing or finding ways to make player movement harder is the way. Look, the NBA has done a really good job of creating parity. And you see it a lot when, if you're a Knicks fan here in this town, we've talked about this, where you know there's a hard cap, and then they start, the NBA starts to, without getting deep into the cap here, reducing your ability to make moves and really punishing you for going above a certain apron. And it makes it hard to round out a roster. In a lot of ways, what I think it does is it allows the big-time players to actually go out, get their money, and maybe some of the next tier. But for those that are on the, you know, back end of the rotation, guys that are component players in the NBA, I think it makes it hard for them to get a good salary. It also makes it hard for them to stay with the same team and build that team that has that connectivity with the fans, similar to what we saw in the 90s with the Knicks. So I think there's a balance here. I certainly think that the league has to take a look at least the international piece, where now if the Dodgers are going to become this pipeline in Japan, and it's happened before. Look, the Dodgers used to be the pipeline into in South America. They always were very successful down there. The Dodgers have been over the years pioneers in player development, going back to Branch Rickey. So let's not pretend that this hasn't happened before. The Yankees used to dominate before there was an amateur draft, where they would always get some of the best players back, you know, in the 40s and whatnot. I don't want to get too deep, and I'm not, you know, in front of me, I don't have the rules and the history and the exact timelines. That's not what the point of this program is. But if you go look in baseball history, and I'm talking conceptually here, this is not the first time this has happened. This is not the first time that a team has used its financial might. We've seen it. This is not the first time a team has had an advantage in an international market. This is not the first time a team has been a desired place to play. So my message to the league, my message to Mets fans, my message to anybody is, you don't like what the Dodgers are doing right now. There's a couple of years before the CBA. And yes, I am immensely concerned about how this impacts the CBA, because you have a number of owners that are very hawkish, that use Steve Cohen as a reason to institute the Cohen tax, they call it, you know, which is kind of ridiculous now, if you really look at it, how the Dodgers are blowing past all that. And, they will be very comfortable shutting down the sport to prove a point. I am very fearful the next CBA after the 2026 season, you are going to see a battle, especially as you continue to see how certain players are being, you know, not just Alonso, Santander, Bregman. They are still big name players that, here it is, we're 2 weeks before February 1st. We're less than a month before pitchers and catchers report. No end in sight. So what you saw with Blake Snell, what you saw with Jordan Montgomery on the pitching side last year, you're seeing now on the, again, Boris is the common denominator here, but you're seeing other component players really struggle to find jobs here. Really struggle to find jobs. And I think that a combination of that on the player side, the owners, the hawkish owners in some of these mid to lower tier markets, they're really going to want to, you know, take a stand here. And I think we could lose. I would not be surprised if we have a similar situation to 1994 in 2027 if things don't start to turn around. And I don't know if Rob Manfred is the kind of leader that will sit back and say, look, the greater good of the sport. And it's a much more dangerous time now, baseball, to go out when we're in an environment where there's a lot of people who are anti-wealth in this country and have grown up being indoctrinated with anti-wealth, not understanding that the pie is the pie, and either one side or the other side is going to get it. And, you know, this could do a lot of harm to the sport. The media won't position the issues, especially the mainstream media, the non-sports media, and even the sports media won't position the issues correctly. They'll take a anti-wealth, poor player, or greedy player, anti-wealth. You know, you pick the narrative and really bastardize the conversation to the average fan. Look, you don't like the money. You don't like the way things are. Here's the solution. You don't watch the games on TV. You don't stream the games and buy apps. You don't talk about the game and you don't go to the game. You basically choke them out financially The salaries come down, the owners don't make money, the sport may die, but you'll recalibrate it. Nobody's willing to do that, because when Tanner Scott and Shohei Ohtani and Freddie Freeman and Blake Snell and the Dodgers, you know, baseball version, the Beatles come rolling into town, people go on to see them. People like dynasties. They don't like, they like them a little bit, and then they get tired of them. So this will be cool for a few years, and then people get tired of them. Now, the thing about the Dodgers, and we'll get to this with the Mets are not there yet. Mets are just in the early stages. The Mets are where the Dodgers were in 2012, 2013. You have to give them credit. The Guggenheimen Group, because yes, it's not Magic Johnson that owns the Dodgers. He's part of the group. He has a percentage ownership, but he is used as the celebrity face of being the Dodgers owner. Took over the club. Frank McCourt was in big-time trouble. He wasn't going to be able to make payroll. And they immediately did what Steve Cohen did, just bring names in, invest, pour cash. Some of it was in bad contracts like a Carl Crawford and things like that. And they were able to make the playoffs every year. And I think in 12 years, they've won a World Series twice. So shows you how hard it is. Remember Billy Epler said a 17% chance to win the World Series? Well, that's 1/6. So he was onto something there. They're at a point now where they've put all this time in. They've built not only an idea of how to use their financial might, but they've also been able to put together a really good development program. You know, they always seem to get pitchers that come in and get better when they come in. They've been able to find undervalued assets like a Max Muncy. They've been able to bring in top prospects and use those prospects too, whether they panned out or not, to get guys like Mookie Betts. They've done everything that the Mets right now with Stearns is really year two. I mean, the Mets under Cohen went through a transition. They went through really not having any kind of leadership with Sandy Alderson was a caretaker. They had all the chaos of 2021. We've talked about it. Then Epler comes in and he was kind of like, I'll take it. Nobody wants the job. I'll take it. And then you know what happened here. And they finally got Stearns. And that's where I go to with Pete Alonso. Because rather than worry about the Dodgers, like I said, nothing's going to change for them, at least the next couple of years. And quite honestly, the changes that need to happen, I think, are tweaks. Maybe on the international level, I'm not for a salary cap. You know, maybe, you look at ways to figure out how the deferred money kind of comes into play with maybe some of the, the way that you look at finances, and maybe you put some penalties on roster movement to a certain degree, like the NBA does. But I think you have to take a hard look at what that will do to certain subsets of the players. And how it hurts the players financially. Maybe if you allow the big-time players to get the money, typically when it comes to the Players Association, the big guys get the money, they don't give a you-know-what about the bottom feeders. But that's a longer, more in-depth conversation for another day. So here we are, year two of Stearns, and we've had, I think, or what has happened in the last couple of days is our first crisis between Stearns and the fans. Because I think, last offseason, Stearns came in when it was already being positioned by Billy Epler and Steve Cohen that they were going to reboot. And I think Stearns had the right idea. Hey, we're not stepping back and not being competitive. We're just going to take a look at this thing. We're not going to dive into big-time commitments or make a trade like the Yankees made to get Soto until we know what we got. And lo and behold, he put together a roster and had enough bones on this roster to come within two wins of the World Series, which is way better than I think any of us could have imagined after where they were when they sold off Verlander and Scherzer at the trade deadline in 2023. So, as I said, coming into this offseason, every point in team history, they have not been able to leverage these opportunities. I've had this conversation. I'm not going to repeat myself about why. And that's where the Soto conversation came into play. And not only did they land Soto, they grabbed him from the crosstown Yankees, which immediately put their offense in a good place. But it's not enough, and I still think they're a bat short, to be quite honest, unless you believe Brett Beatty is going to be a 15 to 20 home run, 800-plus OPS, solid defender, lefty bat in that lineup. I'm not sure Vientos, who I still worry about some regression, Beatty at third, Lindor at short, McNeil at second, that infield, because you have a pretty good outfield with Soto and Nimmo, and then you have your defensive guy in center, or maybe Tyrone Taylor can maybe give you a little bit more offensively than Jose Siri. I'm not sure that that's a complete offensive lineup. I know I'm leaving out Alvarez behind the plate. So you know, Stearns is now, by walking away from Pete Alonso, boxing himself into a corner because there's really only a couple of options outside of Pete Alonso left. You're either going to improve at third, first, or DH. We've talked about this since the beginning of the offseason. So Bregman fits that mold. Santander fits that mold. And really, who else that's impactful that you could say with a high level of confidence on the offensive side can come in and be and make a difference? I mean, think about that. That's it. You have three guys. Pete's one of them. He's off the table, supposedly. I'm not so sure he's 100% off the table, by the way. The only other option you can go offensively is to go internally with Beatty or hedge your bet a little bit because you don't even know if Vientos is going to be a good enough first baseman. I don't think it's hard to learn first. I have a feeling that, you know, there might be some growing pains, especially on tough plays with bunts and things like that. But then you go out and maybe the other option is, well, let's bring a veteran in at the corners. You know, Yoan Moncada, an Anthony Rizzo, a Jose Abreu at first, maybe if you want to keep Vientos at third, and see if they have anything left. I mean, it was only a couple of years ago that Abreu was an elite offensive player, fell off the cliff in Houston. Hey, Pete Alonso, now you know why. So Stearns is boxed in the corner, and I'll get into the Alonso part in a minute because I think there's a lot to it with the fan reaction, but you have a new world order here when it comes to David Stearns. And he showed you last offseason, he has a spine of steel. Last offseason, all the media did all offseason is talk about how bad the Mets were and how they're rebuilding and how they're no good. And I don't care what Stearns says, they're competitive. They're not competitive. And he could have easily taken that and to shut everybody up. And I'm pretty sure if I'm Steve Cohen and I have his money and I'm a big fan and I'm investing in this team, there are times I call him up and go, are you sure, David, we shouldn't do something here? We shouldn't jump in on Montgomery or Snell and throw big money at them? And he's like, no, let's stick to the plan. He stuck to the plan. And even when this team was in the gutter, up until Memorial Day, and it looked like it was going to spiral out of control, he didn't panic. He kept reiterating what he thought is, hey, I built the team. And the way I know how to build a team and the information I have and the way that I look at the game, I know I have a good club. And, you know, the more that you look at Stearns, and here it is now, he takes a popular player who in a lot of ways makes too much sense on a short-term deal for the Mets to sign. And let's face it, the reports are the reports, but he is willing to walk away from the bargaining table, put all this risk and the fact that you may not have the ability to make up, even in a down year, Pete's going to give you 30-90. 30 home runs, 90 RBIs, and prodigious power, and a guy who just came off one of the biggest moments, postseason moments in team history, one of the most dramatic moments in postseason team history. A popular player. Was he 15th, somebody told me, on X when jersey sales? I mean, a guy that does all this great stuff for homeless animals, has this gregarious personality, has been a big presence. Anytime he's in the conversation, he's a big presence when it comes to the fans and the media. He is going to let that guy walk for $20 million, reportedly, because he doesn't think that he's that, you know, he has his value. Now, you could certainly make the argument that you've heard out there that proves he never really wanted him all along. I'm not so sure. I think that he knows what Pete's value is and he knows the risks going forward. And I think he's also looking at it, you know, even with a short-term deal, that as things evolve, as the game begin, you know, with all this outcry about the Dodgers, there could be a time where you can't just spend money whenever you want to fix a problem. Because the rules are going to be like the NBA, maybe, where they prevent you from doing that. And you may not be able to keep your team together because you can't fit guys in some kind of, I'm not saying a salary cap, because I think that shuts the sport down, financial structure. So he can't just give out what the fans are, give Pete 6 or 7 years, spread out the payments, because in 2029, The Mets might be in a situation where they need X, and Pete's Y in a declining situation where he looks like late career Richie Sexton, or God forbid falls off a cliff like Jose Abreu just did with Houston, is clogging up the flexibility. Not because they can't afford it, because it's just the rules. And to be fair, Pete Alonso has never been as good. And I think we talked about this many, many years ago. Those who have worked, who have listened to this show and look at how I've worked when it comes to looking at things. When Pete had that fantastic rookie year with the 53 home runs and, the highest walk rate of his career, and won the home run derby, did everything right from the minute he stepped foot in Port St. Lucie. He has never reached those heights. Now, he had a really good 2022, but since 2022, since that season ended, it's been a precipitous decline. And everybody talks about how, $70 to $72 million for 3 years is an insult. Well, by the way, the last 2 years combined, Pete's total value the last 2 years is about $39 or $40 million bucks. It's about an average of $20 per year. 30% lower than the player who, after 2022, when Aaron Judge was signing that big contract and he was hitting as many, if not more, home runs than Judge, a guy like me came on here and said he's a guy that's going to want a 10-year, $300 million contract and somebody's going to give it to him. No scenario did I believe that Pete would be in this spot right now. And I'm not blaming Boris. I do think that he is doing what he was hired to do. If Boris goes out and accepts a deal that is not as lucrative as the one that reportedly, again, Pete turned down when Billy Upler was the GM in the spring of 2023, in a lot of ways, if I'm Pete, I'm like, why did I hire you? I could have had my last representation do that. So he almost has to work this and save face. Now, it could get to a situation where, similar to Robbie Cano in the Yankees many years ago, Freddie Freeman in the Dodgers is a really recent example, where Pete winds up signing somewhere else really, really late and maybe gets an okay deal, but not significantly more than maybe what the Mets offered, and he goes and leaves a place that it seems like a perfect fit. Now, Freddie Freeman went to the Dodgers, and that worked out pretty well for him. And the Braves, all due respect, have moved on rather nicely from Freddie Freeman since he left. I mean, they had great seasons. I mean, they had some injuries this year, but it's not like they missed a beat without Freddie Freeman. They found a way to make up for it. Now, they brought in Matt Olson, which helps, and do the Mets have their Matt Olson? Now, I don't even want to get into the Vlad Guerrero stuff because I just don't think the Mets ripping apart the farm system for 1 year Guerrero like the Yankees did with Soto is something that you really can do when you're looking at the economics of baseball right now. You're looking at how expensive it is to compete and compete with the Dodgers. You need to have as much cost-controlled talent that you develop through your farm system as possible, especially on the pitching side. And Stearns knows that. And he doesn't care, Stearns, that a Joe Benigno is going to yell at the clouds on WFAN, calling him an elitist, and he doesn't respect the fans and what they think. You're damn right, Joe. Because I heard that. He doesn't care what the fans think, because if you listen to the fans as the GM, you are sitting with them pretty soon. You know, he's got a 5-year deal. That goes by quick. You get evaluated quickly. In a snap of a fingers, it'll be 3 years from now. And at that point, if the Mets are doing the same things that they could have done with Epler or they did under the Wilpons, why did you bring this guy in for $10 million a year? His edict was not just to go out and spend Cohen's money. Any executive could have did that. It was to give him good, sound advice on how to spend the money and get the most value and build the most sustainable situation where they don't have to go 2 or 3 years and reset and reboot because they have all this bloated money because they overpaid for a B-minus talent because he happened to be in the market, the best available, and the fans wanted him. If Stearns is a guy that is willing to walk away when the fans and the media are in Pete's corner, where he just had this iconic moment where he wasn't great in the postseason, but he had big home runs. He had a couple big home runs against the Phils. Obviously, he had the home run to keep them alive against the Dodgers. If he could walk away from Pete over $20 million, which in Cohen's world, if he called Cohen up, I don't think Cohen would have any, again, it's reported, any issue doing 390 with the opt-outs. That deal could have been done and signed earlier this week. If he could walk away from that and not be concerned or show any kind of ability to be swayed by peripheral people that have no impact in the process, like the fans and the media, then you know this guy has a spine of steel and you know you have the right guy for the job. And are you surprised? After, I mean, we kind of forget because things have been so good around here since Memorial Day between the run, the Soto situation. This is like the first negative news that we've experienced here in Mets world since last spring when things looked like they were spiraling out of control. It's almost like we can't handle it. For years, I sat and listened to Mets fans complain about the Wilpons, about the meddling. Let the cook cook. Remember the old Bill Parcells thing? Let the chef cook. Let the chef pick the ingredients and cook. And we heard about how, you know, they wanted Chaim Bloom. They didn't want Jody Van Wagenen. They were all about these analytical front offices like the Red Sox and obviously the Dodgers and the Rays where, you know, those guys run the show. They find all this value. They find all these great assets. They don't have to go out and spend $1 zillion on a middle reliever. And now they have somebody who puts a lot of those things into the blender. I think uses a lot of non-analytical common sense so far in his way of running the team. You finally have that. And he's telling you, I have major concerns about this player. I know he's popular. I know I could use him. Anybody could use a 30 home run bat, especially when I have a need at a corner. And he is now doing what you expected someone of his pedigree, of his ilk, of his type of background, the things that got him competitively in the playoffs every year in Milwaukee with the deck stacked against him far more than he is here in New York, and you're complaining about it. That's really where we're at. And to me, you know, I don't like this. This whole Pete thing has bothered me because I think it makes no sense for him not to, along with Stearns, find an agreement. I think it's like two sides that belong together, at least for the next couple of years. And I can't see any reason why they can't come to an agreement. I think it's Stearns. I don't want to say he's being stubborn. I think that Stearns had, there's something more to this than meets the eye. I think Pete has overvalued himself. And I think you have Boris who has to justify the fact that he came in, he swooped in and probably pitched Pete on the fact that, hey, you know, I got Prince Fielder this, I got Mark Teixeira that, this is who they were, and I know those are old, antiquated contracts, here's where you are. And I'm sure the fact that he's had, in his first 5 years, more home runs than guys like Ralph Kiner and Ryan Howard, and he was right there with Judge until the last couple of years, I'm sure that played into this whole thing, where he thought he was going to get the magic 30 number. I always knew, and I told you guys a couple of years ago, and people laughed, that's what this guy wanted, that number 30. Once Judge got that, once that became kind of like the gold bar of AAV for top-notch, very good all-star plus players, I knew that's what he wanted. I find it hard that these two sides can't come together. And quite honestly, I mean, you hear Toronto bandied about, you hear San Francisco, the Cubs owner talked about, hey, I don't, you know, acting like they're on austerity. You want to talk collusion? We've been down this road in various off seasons the last two decades. As I've been covering the sport, this is not the first time I've seen a frigid off season. It seems like it goes in ebbs and flows. We get these frigid periods where the owners are like, hey, I just don't want to pay these prices. It's like at some point when you go to the supermarket, there are certain things that are just not worth the price and you could live without them. And right now there are owners who think they could live without Santander, Pete Alonso, and even Alex Bregman for what they're asking for. Now, there are teams that could use them, and things could change overnight. If Pete lingers into spring training, you're not going to tell me some team's going to wake up March 1st and say, you know, I really think I'll sign him. Give him 30-something for a year. I could do that for a year. And Pete says, all right, that's all I got. Let me show the league who I am and take this. Maybe that's the Mets. Because if Pete had something else going, I have to think that the reports of the Mets and them pivoting on, what was it, Thursday or Friday, I have to think that you would have started to see some progress. Boris is a pretty good leak. I mean, he's got frigging guys like Heyman that always put out his stuff in the most accurate manner. I mean, we kind of saw the Soto thing play out. We got a rather good information and how that played out. Maybe he played the media a little bit with where it was going. So I have to think that there's still a small hope. And the Mets going on their plan B is part of not a negotiating strategy. It's part of it. But it's also because they got to start building this team. You can't wait for this negotiation to drag into Valentine's Day. And then, you know, the component players, the Minters, the Winkers, these guys all fall off the board. Now you can say, you know what, I'm going to put Pete into this, you know, salary, and I'm going to build around that salary, this roster. Now it's even gotten harder for Pete, because as the Mets fill out the Minters and the bullpen, and they bring in Winker, and maybe they bring back Iglesias, and who knows if they have something else in mind for depth or for pitching, you know, that budget starts to shrink. Now they're going to go over $300 million. They're going to pay the tax. Somebody pointed out there's also the draft pick compensation part of going over that Stearns might be looking at and saying, hey, this is going to be a problem. We keep losing, you know, or getting penalized on the draft side, and how are we ever going to build controllable high-end talent out of the farm system without good draft positioning? Fans don't care about that when you want to win a championship and you just sign Juan Soto. And the other thing Pete has, he's got that qualifying offer attached to him, so that applies for other teams. He doesn't have a lot of options. And I said a couple of weeks ago, I knew that this was going into dangerous territory. It was a game of chicken. Pete was being in a dangerous situation. The Mets are in a dangerous situation. They really need each other. But and I'll tell you what. Stearns, I think, is the one that has more to lose. Because I think Pete's going to land somewhere, something similar to what he turned down for the Mets. And I think he'll eventually get 390. I got to think a team, because of who he is, and with the opt-outs in play, would say, I got to take a chance on this. He's sitting there too long. This is like the equivalent of a fantasy draft where a player keeps dropping and dropping and dropping. For some reason, the league's not buying into him. And at some point, you're in the mid to late rounds. You look at that name, you're like, he's here? Not a perfect fit. I might have to move some things around, but shoot, it's too good to pass up. The Mets, on the other hand, if they are truly going to go into spring training with Brett Beatty as their third baseman, Vientos at first, McNeil at second, Lindor at short, Alvarez behind the plate, your Nimmo, your Siri / Taylor, and Soto lineup, not bad. I think it's a bad short, because my question is, do you believe Mark Vientos is going to be at or better than he was last year? You know, after the fact, he didn't even make the team a year ago. Look, he was impressive in the playoffs, but there's some questions there. We know the up and downs of McNeil. Lindor, you feel pretty good about, but he's a year older and he plays the middle infield. God forbid he gets hurt. Beatty, we've documented his challenges here with the speed of the game, the focus, and how disappointing he's been, and how I don't think he's all that good. Alvarez, he could certainly improve and make up some of Pete's power and run production, but he's a catcher. He's going to need time off, because catchers need time off. And he's shown some warts in his game on both the offensive and defensive side, with patience, plate discipline, the mental aspect of it. Brandon Nimmo has some health issues. Soto is just one guy. You can't just have one guy bat nine times. And center field is a defensive position, and it's probably going to be like that unless you find that elite defense-offense combo that, you know, under Stearns, because he values defense up the middle. And you have no idea when a Jet Williams, a Drew Gilbert, a Ronnie Mauricio is coming off a significant injury, when these guys are going to be ready and available. You know, there's you know, they just started rebuilding the farm positionally under Stearns. The starting pitching's okay. It's a bit component-driven. Now they got A.J. Minter and Diaz. I like that. I like the fact that Minter has experience. It could probably back up closing. You know, a lefty doesn't walk a lot of guys, coming off a pretty significant injury. We saw how David Peterson kind of revived himself after getting the hip fix, so maybe the Mets feel confident about that. But this, you know, the Mets start out bad in April and May again this year, like they did a year ago. And sometimes magic doesn't strike twice. What the Mets did was pretty significant in 2024. You can't count on that. You could meander around the season for 60 to 70 games and make a wild card. and player, but you don't want a full 10, 12 games under 500. And in this town, where the fans are going to be pissed off, the media is going to play to that, any kind of struggles by Beatty at third, any kind of success that Alonso has elsewhere is going to be thrown in their face over and over and over again. And God forbid, somehow he winds up in the division, the Phillies, the Marlins, the Nats, for whatever reason. And he's doing it against them. He comes back and he hits a couple home runs and beats them at Citi Field. We're going to have to do an emergency show here at the Talking Mets podcast. You know, and I'll tell you what, this has, more than anything, and I'll leave you guys and I'll wrap up with this because we got to, you know, part, like I said, there's going to be a part two. Part two will come out on Monday. I'm feeling, there was, when the news came out that Pete wasn't coming back, and I had some people contact me, those who have long listeners of the show. Someone told me he had dreams about Pete leaving. Our good friend over in across the pond, Liam, talking about how you know, his journey becoming a baseball fan coincided with Pete coming up at the Mets in 2019. I mean, how many players are on a first-name basis that's not manufactured by the media? We call him Pete. He started out as Peter Alonso. He went to Pete Alonso. He went to the Polar Bear. Now he's Pete. So that tells you how important he's been to the team. And I've seen Murphy leave. I've seen Strawberry leave. I've seen DeGrom leave. Reyes signed somewhere else. You know, we've seen guys leave. I mean, Mets fans remember Seaver. Now, let's take Seaver and Seaver being traded and put that in a whole different pantheon. Different generation, different type of player. I mean, I was bothered when Strawberry left. And that turned to really disliking Strawberry because he talked a lot of trash out the door. And we could go on and on and on about how that was a similar situation where both sides really needed to work something out. And Frank Cashin took a pretty similar stance with Strawberry. That, you know, but in that situation, LA and Strawberry's agent and the Dodgers were calling. That was home. So that was a much more dangerous play. Murphy, there was a lot of debate about how sustainable Murphy was. It's funny, DeGrom should have hurt more. Verlander, I think that they signed him almost immediately after, kind of helped with the shock of it. I think we were preparing for it because you kept hearing he didn't want to stay and he wanted to go somewhere else. One day, you know, Buck denies that when you've heard Buck talk, but there's a certain amount of mystery as to really how badly both sides did or didn't want each other, and I was bothered by it. But the fact that DeGrom really hasn't pitched much for Texas, maybe it hasn't sunk in totally. Maybe he goes out and wins a Cy Young this year, it'll hurt more. But this hurt more. Like, for whatever reason, this is like Strawberry level. Like, and I don't know, and even when Reyes left, that bothered me, that stung, because Jose was that energizer bunny, part of those disappointing Mets teams. And we'll get more into Wright and Reyes. Well, not so much Reyes, he's off the ballot, but I believe because of Beltran and Wright being on the ballot, those 06, 07, 08 Mets will come up more in part two when we do it. But this hurt. It's because I think Pete is a fun guy to watch. Not many people in the history of the game can have the power that he has. He's always wanted the big moment. And he has one of the more iconic swings and home runs in Mets history that we'll be watching 20 years from now and remembering, regardless of whether he goes on and plays somewhere else, which it looks like he probably will. You know, he's always going to be welcome back. And I think that that's a rare situation. DeGrom had an arm's length relationship with the organization, the fans, in my opinion. We never really got to know him like Pete. Murphy, even if he had come back, he only had a couple of years left in him as he had an injury. His knee was going down. And I think at times there was a pull between the Murphy that we saw for so many years and then the enhanced version that remade himself, and you really didn't believe it, you know? And Strawberry was so long ago, and that was a much different situation, different team, different era. Not as pertinent, but that, you know, this kind of falls into that. And I think you're going to see a lot of backlash when Pete signs somewhere else. I think there's going to be a lot of angry fans. I think there's going to be a lot of fans who are going to be mad at the Mets. And Stearns eventually, and I think there's a fan fest coming up. I don't know if he's going to be there, but Stearns eventually is going to have to speak to this and say, hey, you know, not that he's going to talk about negotiations, but where you know, where did this go bad? How can two sides that really need each other, how can this go bad? Because now I see one of two things happening. They don't land Bregman or Santander. The only other option is they go with the kid, Brady, who's not becoming so much of a kid after, now we're on year, what, 4, 22, 23, 24, 25, of Brady coming in and having some kind of big league presence. Do they bring in an Anthony Rizzo to caddy in case they, you know, Brady falls flat on his face, you put Vientos back at third? I mean, that is not going to be something that Mets fans are going to really be happy about. It puts more pressure on Soto. Soto gets off to a 180 start in April, and Pete's hitting the crap out of the ball in Oakland. I mean, could you see, like, Oakland, who's spending money, pop in and say, hey, Pete, you want to come hang out in Sacramento for a year and make some money, remake yourself? Something like that. I mean, it's just crazy. It's crazy when you think about it. And it's disappointing. It's disappointing that we're here. I think there's a lot of reasons for it. I don't think Stearns is all wrong. I don't think Boris is all wrong. I'd love to know what's going through Pete Alonso's mind. He probably feels, you know, obviously this is the cold business side of the game. And that's Stearns' job. Stearns' job is not to listen to the fans. That's what Jeff Wilpon did. If Jeff Wilpon was the owner of the Mets or involved, Pete Alonso would have gotten that contract. And they may have sacrificed Minter, Winker, or other down roster components that eventually will rear itself to be problematic and cost the Mets in a big way. You got to fit Pete into this flow within whatever their financial parameters are. There's always financial parameters. But to Joel Sherman's point, and I'll wrap it up here. He said this in the Post this morning or over the weekend. There's always that thought in your mind, like the night he was having martinis in Hawaii, Cohen, and Correa, and Boris called him out, Correa, that he's going to say, hey, he's there, he's lingering. And when I say he's there, he's lingering, that could apply for anyone. Oakland and San Francisco, Toronto, and they just say, okay, that guy's too good to be sitting around. I'll get him on 1 year. I don't have a problem overpaying for a year. Maybe that's where this goes. Maybe it's a one-year deal. So we'll see. So I hope everybody enjoyed part one here of a two-parter. So it's Sunday night. This will be going up here on Sunday night. Stay tuned on Monday, holiday. If you're off, enjoy it. Rest. And the big Hall of Fame Talking Mets show. I reveal my ballot. I talk a little bit. Is David Wright still on the ballot? And I'll chime in a little bit about Wright's number being retired. Beltran, of course, is back on the ballot. We'll see if he gets induction. Another local, CeCe Sabathia, Ichiro for the first time. I have a couple of controversial thoughts about the ballot. I think you guys will want to weigh in on that. I've already teased it a little bit over on X about CeCe Sabathia, so go over there and see what I said. And we'll have a lot of fun. I always enjoy talking about the Hall of Fame. It's not always Mets-related. There's a lot of Mets-related components to this, especially if Billy Wagner gets in or Beltran gets in. You're starting to see guys who didn't make all their career about the Mets, but big parts of Mets eras getting inducted. And look, I think Beltran goes in as a Met. Wagner, probably an Astro. That's debatable, but he had some good times with the Mets. So it'll be interesting to see what comes down on Tuesday as the BBWAA announces their selections for the 2025 Hall of Fame class. So want to thank everybody for tuning in to part one of this two-part edition of the Talking Mets podcast. You can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. You get me on X at Talking Mets No G and on your favorite podcasting service, Apple, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at talkingmetspodcast.com. No G. Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. You get me on Instagram, TalkingMetsNoG, and I'd love for you to subscribe to the newsletter, Substack.com/@TalkingMetsNoG. And I want to thank the good folks from the Fansided Podcasting Network for supporting this show. I'm your host, Mike Silva. Enjoy the rest of your weekend. We'll be back with part two Monday, the Talking Mets Hall of Fame show. Till then, take care, everybody. For the